Hi, this is Paul. I haven't done much Jordan Peterson stuff lately. Some of you will be happy about that. Some of you will miss it. It doesn't mean he hasn't been doing some good work. Actually, it just mostly is a lot of the conversations and topics he's been doing. They're interesting to me, and I listen to a lot of them, but I just haven't, in some ways, just the little drama in the little corner has taken a lot of my time and attention in terms of my limiting viewing time. But I did want to say a few things about some of the recent videos. Number one, he's doing a lot better as a conversation partner in many of these videos. He's interrupting less. He's interjecting less. He's letting his guests speak more. It's really good. It's really good. Some of the videos that he's done recently, I started watching the Alberta new premiere. That was very interesting. I'd spoken with a friend about, you know, Jacob in the just streaming yesterday mentioned his concerns about a 2024 civil war. My take is Canada's going to break up before the United States is going to break up, and it's probably going to be the East and the West Coast staying together, and Alberta, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan staying together, and Quebec going its own way. I think in a lot of ways, some of the prairie provinces might feel more at home with American prairie politics, but who knows? I'm not really a politician, so I thought it was a very interesting conversation, and that he has it on his channel. But again, he's much better in terms of talking to these people, and that was quite good. His conversation with Andrew Schultz was very interesting. There were a ton of little really interesting tidbits and nuggets and insights in that video. What I found surprising about that video is I didn't find Andrew Schultz very likable. I'd never heard of him before, and I just didn't find him terribly likable in the video. Maybe if I go and watch some of his comedy, I'll laugh, but I found him rather annoying, and in that video, I'd kind of hoped that Peterson would interject a little bit more, because I just didn't find Schultz terribly likable. I was just going to skip the Yoram Hazony video completely, because if the video is mostly just sort of about woke, anti-woke stuff, it's kind of mapped territory for me, so don't find it a lot interesting, but there was actually quite a bit interesting in there in terms of conservatism. That's been a big theme for Jordan lately. And then I wanted to play, because I'd been talking about sanity and collective relevance realization, in the Schultz video, it was about 35 minute mark, and in the Hazony, the Marxism video, Peterson mentioned in both video that when he was doing these videos, he was thinking a lot about sanity, and about sanity not being in just the previous model that is dominant, that sanity is that something in your head. So I thought I'd at least play the clip from this, because Dog Bark in the comments section mentioned don't give up the sanity thread. And there's way too many threads I often give up, but that is an important thread, because I think this actually connects with the collective relevance realization talk, and it connects with maybe I'll play some later stuff in this video. I quite liked this conversation. Again, a lot of the woke, anti-woke stuff is sort of map territory for me, so I find it rather dull, the complaining about it. But some of the talk about religion, the guy's from New Jersey, obviously about my age, so there was kind of a neat connection. But
so it seems to me that you could make a case that classic liberalism worked because it was running on stored cultural capital in some sense. Is that when the institutions that you're speaking about were more...
And this is what happens if I don't do quite enough prep. That's the more of this. Here's the sanity section. They had it nicely segmented out.
Just to this mess, because there was a tremendous emphasis probably throughout the whole 100-year course of the development, say, of clinical psychology and clinical psychiatry, on sanity as something in some real sense internal to the individual. And so you can see that, I would say, in its most stellar exemplars in the humanist psychologists of the 1960s, and it kind of figures that that would occur in the 1960s, that you were sane and capable of psychological well-being if you were well-constituted psychologically. But I've been thinking more recently that that's not a very useful model of sanity, because it downplays the social embeddedness that characterizes people who are psychologically stable and therefore capable of happiness. If you're stable, you're not anxious, you're not completely ridden with negative emotion. That doesn't necessarily mean you're happy, but if you do a careful analysis of what people mean when they say they want to be happy, what they really mean is they don't want to be miserable. And happiness is like the icing on the cake, but they definitely don't want to be anxious and frustrated and disappointed and in pain and confused and aimless and all of that. And so it isn't obvious to me at all that it's possible to be psychologically intact in isolation. I think the most potent proof of that is even that even hardened criminals, antisocial types, find being in solitary confinement almost intolerable. And so if that's the case, you might ask, well, what exactly is social being doing for us? And if you're married, you have someone who's somewhat different than you to keep you in check constantly. Like married couples are throwing back and forth information to each other about how to regulate the relationship and themselves nonstop. That's pretty much all of what communication consists of. And then if you have children or your parents, your siblings, let's say that immediate family, the same thing is happening, is that people are monitoring one another and providing each other with feedback about how to behave and how to think. And then that's nested inside a civic community, and that's nested inside a state or a province, and then that's nested inside a country. And sanity seems to be something like, and maybe all of that's nested inside some religious presuppositions, it's the harmony between all those levels that seems to be essentially what constitutes sanity.
And I don't know if it's necessarily the harmony. Harmony is a good word. I don't know if it's the best word, because, you know, I hate to sound like a correspondence theory truthist, but sanity also, of course, has to match up the propositional, the perspectival. All of the four ways of knowing from Verveke really have to sort of come together. And it is very collective, but you can find, again, real mismatches between, let's say, true sanity and the ideas of the crowd. In other words, your culture can go insane, and everyone will consider you insane. But again, the point is that it's not an individual thing inside your head. That doesn't mean that there aren't insanities that are in your head. There's all sorts of, you know, psychology is real. There are significant mental illnesses that put people seriously out of touch. There are personality disorders. There are other conditions that psychologists and therapists deal with to help people sort of resync and do better. But I think Jordan's comments here were excellent. And I think understanding sanity more broadly is a really helpful thing.
Rather than something that's formally internal, like maybe your internal structure reflects that external harmony, and that's like in a fractal manner, in a holographic manner. And that's what sanity constitutes.
And for people who, let's say, are victims of trauma, could be adult trauma, could be childhood trauma of various kinds. And you know, it's part of the reason that childhood trauma and growing up with some really insane people can sort of make you insane, even, let's say, if biologically things are functioning okay at that level. Because, of course, there's so much mapping that goes on in us as children, and we take those maps out into the world, and in many ways, first in, last out, in terms of our mapping. And so, but again, I think it's really an improvement that sanity is seen with a much broader background than usually what we talk about it in our culture.
I would say that the liberal emphasis on, say, self-actualization and as the on the atomistic self as the center of the world has deluded itself into thinking that any of that's possible without an intact hierarchy of social structure surrounding the individual. That seems to me to be the weakness, the fundamental weakness on the psychological front of even of classic liberalism.
I think this is excellent from Jordan, because this is the I really miss David Fuller in this space. Rebel Wisdom is you know, they were doing really important work, I think, for this little corner, even if they this little corner is all sorts of in many ways overlapping subcommunities, but this is the Jordan Peterson that that we really saw early on, is able to critique even his own areas that he believes in, able to critique classical liberalism, able to critique individualism. And it's very helpful to see him in this way and doing this work.
More deep.
So here he's talking about it in the Andrew Scholes video.
Recently, more explicitly, you know, I've been putting this together, is that the definition of sanity that's generally implicitly held among the psychological community is probably too individualistic. And what I mean by that is that
And again, in terms of Peterson, this is a big piece of self-critique, because many of us have noted his general take on many things is highly individualistic. The individual is sort of the primary. It's a great point when he makes it, but he's also critiquing it and nuancing it. And again, that's really what we want to see.
I don't think that sanity is something that you have in your head. It's not part of your psyche. It's not part of you exactly. It's more like harmonious interaction with the hierarchy of social arrangements that you have with other people.
So, and I don't know, again, if harmonious is the best word. I would say productive and true rather than harmonious, because, and again, I go back to the example of Jesus, who, again, his family wanted to, at one point, the Gospel of Mark talks about this, you know, take him aside. And I found many times if you begin to, with a lot of clarity, explain to someone exactly what Jesus says about living and dying and how to live, people will rightly say, well, that's not sane. Well, why don't they find it sane? Because they're embedded within their own system of beliefs and their own worldview. So sanities are deeply connected to worldviews. Now, a really tremendous video that I haven't heard any chatter about. Brett Anderson has been doing graduate work on Jordan Peterson's work, and he's been on my channel. He's been on John's channel. I should probably have him back on my channel at some point. He's on Twitter, and he's been writing some really good stuff on his Substack and Twitter, sort of digesting Jordan Peterson's work. And I think now he's going to walk through some stuff that if you've read Maps of Meaning, you'll be fairly familiar with it. And Brett really does, I think, a good job of helping to make some of Peterson's tortured prose and Maps of Meaning a little bit more available. And I'll just give you a little taste of this here. I recommend the whole video. It's really a wonderful conversation.
So you break the frame, you have an increase in entropy, which you can think of as a kind of descent into chaos. And then when you form a new frame, what they showed was that you end up with less entropy than you had to start, right?
Yes.
So you start with a moderate level of entropy, you have an increase in entropy, and then you end up with less entropy than you did to start. Okay, that's the structure of the metamythology, right?
Yes.
So the metamythology is you start out with a stable state, right? Some sort of relative stability. You have an anomaly that disrupts that stability. You have a descent into chaos. And then you have, through voluntary confrontation of that chaos, you have a reemergence into a higher state of order.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's
And that's, of course, all classic Peterson stuff. And if you're used to Peterson, you'll have heard versions of this many, many times.
Order, descent into chaos, reemergence into a higher order. That's the structure of the metamythology. It's the structure of an insight. And that is.
And I think this very much links up to sanity, because if the processes are working correctly, this is sanity together. Sanity is not just the function of your own mind connecting to the world. That's part of it. It's also related to the function of your mythologies and your metamythologies.
Is what occurs at the border between order and chaos in both relevance realization and in maps of meaning. And then the third area of overlap is just that Jordan said, you know, Jordan was very explicit about this. He said in Maps of Meaning, the metamythology is the process by which you determine the motivational relevance of novel stimuli. Yeah. Right? So you're presented with a novel information, and it's information that radically disrupts your current belief systems, values, whatever it may be.
Now this is really indicative of sanity, because one of the things that you find with very sane people is that they are able to handle, now he said novel stimuli, that's terribly abstract, they're able to handle unforeseen disruptions and unwelcome disruptions in the midst of a day. And, you know, so for example, with Jesus, Jesus has to handle his arrest and crucifixion, and he has to process this. And of course, all of this is connected from the individual through others. Remember, we do our collective relevance realization through others, but it's all the way connected all the way out to the world. And so sanity, godliness, maturity, good character, all of these things are deeply connected.
And you have to determine, you know, the hardest problem that there is to determine at what level of analysis you should incorporate that anomaly, right? So, you know, one of the examples that Jordan...
And so, for example, someone who's wrestling with catastrophism, meaning that my shoelace broke and I'm on the floor sucking my thumb in the fetal position. Now, the breaking of a shoelace is a small thing. Now, maybe, and so you're... all the way through your systems should be regulated and in tune with the narrative and all the way connected deeply and connected with each other.
Uses is like, if you're on your way to a job interview and the elevator gets stuck, how much should you freak out, right? Like, are you just wasting 5 minutes, or are you losing out on your entire career, your entire future career, right? What is the motivational relevance of this elevator getting stuck? And we're constantly having to solve problems like that, where there is no, and I think you've argued, you know, there's no algorithm for this.
Yes.
There's no algorithm for it. It's a continual process by which we're constantly trying to find this dynamic balance between sort of blowing out our entire belief system and values or not changing things at all.
And that, of course, gets into the long conversation we've been having about transformations, because our belief systems are scaled, they're leveled, and sometimes, you know, let's say someone, Jonathan Peugeot, goes from being an evangelical to Orthodox. Well, the Christian frame remains. He just made a migration within it. Someone who goes from being a Christian to an atheist, well, other things remain. And of course, the mappings of these things are tremendously difficult. They're not always integrated or connected. I've seen people go from Christians to non-Christians, and I find them to be just as judgmental, just as... a whole bunch of negative things that they had when they were Christians, they had that when they're atheists too. And, you know, Clay Rutledge has had a lot of very interesting studies on some of these things.
And so anyway, so that process is what occurs at the border between order and chaos, and it is relevance realization.
Right.
What's the significance of this, and why do we see this overlap? So in Maps of Meaning, you know, what Jordan argued, and he's argued this in his biblical series as well, and Eric Hole has made a somewhat similar argument to this. Anyway, so what we've done is that we observe people throughout history who are doing great things, right? And we observe people for all sorts of reasons, but we tell stories about people, and we told stories about people who do heroic things or great things. And we have all these particular stories, and you know, human beings love to tell stories. There was a paper published in PNAS in like 2018 where they looked at the percentage of communication among this hunter-gatherer group, and 80% of their nighttime communication was telling stories.
Right.
You know, so we love to tell stories, right? It's a huge part of what we do. And but we also love to engage in abstraction, right? We love to generalize. And so what we do, you know, what Jordan Peterson argues is that what we do is we're kind of looking for the line of best fit, right? That something we're looking for a pattern or a story that can incorporate the wisdom that's inherent to all of these particular stories. And we tell that, and it's a fiction, right? But of course, it's not a fiction in terms of being a lie, right? It's a fiction in terms of being the underlying pattern that's not, it's, you know, Eric Hole calls these, they're more real than real, right? They're more true than reality to some degree, because they have a generalizability that's not inherent to any of the particular stories. Now, why does that end up being relevance realization? Why does that end up looking like relevance realization? Well, because the general pattern underlying optimal behavior looks like that pattern, right? It occurs at the border between order and chaos. It involves the ability to frame and reframe the world when necessary. And so if we have abstracted out the general pattern underlying optimal behavior in the world, it should look something like relevance realization, right? I mean,
and of course, optimal behavior in the world is going to align with sanity. Insanity is not optimal because you can't take in the world properly, you can't engage with other people properly, and your life is going to disintegrate.
That's what it is. And part of the importance of this, I think, is that it connects us to our past, right? So I'm a big fan of this literature, the cultural evolution literature, and one of the lessons from that literature is that, you know, tradition has some epistemic authority. And the reason why is because, and you know, this is very different from the way that I thought when I was younger, because when I was 19 and kind of dumb, I would say things like, just because something's been done this way before doesn't mean we should do it this way in the future. But what the cultural evolution literature sort of indicates is like, actually, it is a good way to do it. You know, it is a good reason to do things.
It's been, ceteris paribus. You should listen to it. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been doing it this way for 10,000 years, you know, and we're not extinct, right? So that's a pretty good indication that it's not entirely dumb. And I think that it's actually my and I don't have any research about this, but my intuition is actually that this is a source of meaning as well. And that being disconnected from our past and disconnected from our traditions. Well, I think you maybe touched on this in your book about domicide, right?
Yeah.
Being disconnected from our traditions is a source of nihilism. And what Jordan's ideas and maps of meaning do and what they do is they connect us to our past in a way that we can actually believe, right? We're trying to figure out what was implicit in these stories rather than the explicit historical interpretation of them, which I think many of us don't believe that anymore. We can't believe that anymore.
And you can even see at the time of the Greeks that, like, at least Plato and, you know, and Socrates, they're not really believing the historical, but that doesn't mean they throw the myth away.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. Now I have three sort of threats.
And so if you want to hear John's rebuttal, you can. But this was a tremendous video where Brett really sort of lines up John's work on relevance realization and Jordan's work on mythology and heroes. And I think that really maps onto the sanity conversation because, you know, and so all of these virtues, sobriety, sanity, truth, temperance, all of these things come together. And that's really what we're looking for.
That idea also highlights, in some sense, both the practical necessity and the inevitability of faith or the lack thereof. I mean, many things in your life you have to throw yourself into without first knowing that you can do it. And I don't mean to do that in an impulsive and foolish manner, like heedless of all risks. I mean that when you get married, you don't know if it's going to work. And in some sense, that's even a foolish question because the issue is that when you...
Part of what brought me back to this video was after I did the marriage crisis video, someone in the comment section said, wow, this really lines up with Jordan's conversation on Marxism. And I thought, that video was about Marxism?
Decide to get married. It's the first and foremost decision among 50,000 decisions that are going to determine whether or not you can stay married. And you can boil that down to a question like, did I marry the right person? And the answer to that is always no. And they didn't marry the right person either. And because neither of you are the right person in your current unbelievably flawed condition. And so, but you throw yourself into it thinking that having faith that you can manage it, and also having faith that the alternative, that no matter how dismal the reality, the alternative is likely to be far worse. And I would say the same thing is true on the child-rearing front, which is, as you pointed out, it's difficult. It isn't obvious that you're prepared or that extra preparation is really going to help you. But what's the alternative to the difficulty? One of the things I love about the story of Abraham, one of the things I think that makes it such a profound story, is that Abraham is really characterized by quite the protracted adolescence, according to the beginning of the story. He's quite old when God finally convinces him to get the hell out of his tent and to get out there in the world. And God in that story is definitely manifests himself as the call to adventure, even to the pathologically underdeveloped, the call to adventure. And
part of the reason I wanted to move around my office is so that I can move around, because I'm actually I could never sit still my whole life. So it's nice to have, not to be trapped in that little corner back there. So, and then some people will say, oh yeah, you are tall.
Of course, Abraham just steps into any number of catastrophes as soon as he leaves the confines of his tent and his father's home. But the story is a triumph in its totality, because despite the fact that he encounters tyranny and the likely loss of his wife at the hands of people who are essentially tyrants, and starvation and war and all of the catastrophes of life, he has a great adventure. And that's the adventure, as far as I can tell, it's something like the adventure of truth and dedication and responsibility. And that's very seldom.
And of course, sanity maps onto that, because going back to the book of Genesis, if a local warlord or king or pharaoh wants to take your wife, okay, so was it sanity for Abraham to call her his sister? Well, he's his half-sister, so it's a half-lie. And of course, Isaac goes through the same thing with Rebecca. So, I mean, all this stuff maps on together. This was a good conversation too. So there's some good videos out there. And again, really, Peterson. I think Peterson, the Daily Wire thing, I think is settling down now. Again, with many of these videos, he's doing a lot of the biographical things on the Daily Wire only section. So if you don't really care about that part, you don't necessarily have to watch it. I personally love the biographical stuff, and of course, everyone who watches any of my Randos videos knows that that's you know, I'm here for the story. I want to know you, and so in order for me to know you, I'm going to have to know your story, and I'm going to be judging your sanity by what you've done with all of the chaos that's come into your life, and maybe you've done poorly at it, but maybe you've learned from it. And that's so we actually grow in sanity as we grow in virtue and we grow in wisdom. So I just wanted to do another video with some of the Jordan Peterson stuff. So let me know what you think. Leave a comment.